welcome in. It's the All Ball Podcast. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and you can check out the Doug Gottlieb Show every day, 3 to 6 Eastern Time, 12 to 3 Pacific. Thanks so much for joining me. My guest this week is the head coach at UC Irvine. They just finished 31-6, 15-1 in the Big West, won their first ever NCAA tournament game. They took down Big 12 champion Kansas State. We'll catch up with Russ Turner in a moment. I did want to share with you a couple of different hoop thoughts. I found one thing to be ironic. You know, like you're having all these guys pull out of Team USA to play in the World Cup, and yet here DeMarcus Cousins gets hurt, you know, playing in an individual workout. And you see all these guys playing, you know, should you double team in open run? You know, that's a discussion in the NBA. How about, I don't understand why you wouldn't go play for Team USA. It baffles my mind, this idea that you want to stay fresh and rested, and yet every video has these guys working out every day, playing ball every day. You wouldn't want to represent your country? And by the way, do it in China where you can build your brand? It doesn't seem like the smartest marketing plan in the world. Nonetheless, that's kind of the world in which we live in. There is something interesting about Dwight Howard. So Dwight Howard's out there and available, and most Laker fans are kind of spitting up in their mouth because they're like, man, maybe we have to sign Dwight Howard in order to replace DeMarcus Cousins. And I was thinking about that Seinfeld where they called George Costanza, can't stand you. And that's the thing with Dwight Howard. Now, a lot of it's gone bad since the end of the Orlando run. But, I mean, I have friends in the NBA. I have guys I know with the Washington Wizards who told me that last year they called all of his previous coaches and every one of them said, like, you know, he's super talented, but he just, guys don't like him, doesn't get along with anybody. And it's just, we're in this weird place where I do think that culture matters. I do think, you know, Carmelo's not being blackballed. Carmelo just can't accept a role that he'd have. And I'm not even sure what that role would be, because even though he can still score, it's more mid-range scoring, and he's a volume guy, and he can't play defense. And then he doesn't buy into the role that he has. So, you know, it's like Iverson, who retired early. You almost feel like this guy's career is over and he doesn't know it. Dwight Howard might be in the same space. And I wonder, I think he's going to get into the Basketball Hall of Fame. I mean, the numbers are incredible. But numbers belie, he's had good numbers everywhere he's been since he left Orlando. And yet he hasn't been able to get along with anybody, which tells you that, you know, whether it's the Lakers or the Rockets underachieving, or, you know, how quickly the Hornets wanted to get rid of him, or Atlanta, his hometown team, like all these teams, like, could not wait to get rid of him after getting him. And what does it say about him? So I know the Lakers are sitting there going, like, look, we don't have a lot of options. But if the option is Dwight Howard, who can't seem to fit in everywhere he's been, you're like, well, maybe he'll make, because he makes less money, he'll buy in. I just don't see it. I don't feel it. I don't feel it. I can't really lie to you. So, you know, I think it's going to be fascinating to see what happens with Dwight, what happens with the Lakers. But it's interesting. Like, are we going to do the Pro Basketball Hall of Fame the Basketball Hall of Fame, it's not the Pro Basketball Hall of Fame. We're going to do the Naismith Memorial Hall of Fame like we do the Baseball Hall of Fame? Is it simply going to be a stat-driven deal? If it's a stat-driven deal, then you put Dwight Howard in and you don't think twice about it. And he was a dominant player for a long time. But, I mean, with still a juice in the tank, and some of it is the NBA has passed him by in terms of style. But he's still putting up numbers. The numbers don't tell you what he really brings. If it was just about numbers, he'd be on any of these previous teams. But he's not. Because he's just a hard guy to really love playing with or getting along with. And I think the Lakers will probably see that. You know, Marcin Gortat and Cody Zeller, those are some of the other options. I wouldn't be surprised if they passed on the guy who's the most talented and he costs you like nothing in order to get somebody who they feel like fits better. And the Lakers need 18, 20 minutes a game from somebody. And I think that Dwight Howard has 18, 20 minutes a game. But it's just kind of a weird existence, isn't it? It sure does seem that way. Last thing before we get to Russ Turner. Ty Lue is the new assistant coach of the LA Clippers. And while that should be celebrated because the Clippers continue to load up with, you know, bright mind after bright mind, Rex Kalamanian running their defense, Their front office is spectacular. Their head coach is Doc Rivers, who everybody likes. And now you bring in a guy who's won NBA championship as an assistant. You know, it's the tit for tat with what the Lakers have. But he could have been the head coach of the Lakers. And I know that there's a lot of pride there. Like, I don't want 3 years and $6 million, $18 million, whatever. But he could have been head coach of the Lakers, which is more money and granted more stress. He's had some problems dealing with stress. But as much as we can celebrate it for the Clippers, for Ty Lue, that was a job. The Lakers' job was a job that if he had taken it, it had limitless potential. You know, you get to one NBA Finals and all of a sudden you get an extension, or yet you command yourself a huge contract elsewhere whenever you want to leave. And I think turning that down, now he's kind of regressed back to being, he'll still be a viable option, but you could have been the head coach of the Lakers, and there's only one LA Lakers. And you have LeBron James. I don't know how, I mean, I think their roster is pretty good. I don't know how it ultimately plays out, but I would have rather been head coach of the Lakers than assistant coach of the Clippers, and the money is probably three times as much, at least. Maybe six. Money's not everything, and you got to be comfortable with what you're doing, and you got to feel respected, and he'll feel that with the Clippers, but he doesn't have more than a three-year deal with the Clippers. He's not making $6 million for the Clippers, and he's not the head coach. He doesn't get credit for the wins. So, something to chew on. Check out all my interviews on the Doug Gottlieb Show podcast as well. Make sure you download that wherever you downloaded this. And don't forget to not only rate, write a comment, subscribe, download, tell a friend, tweet it out. This is good stuff. Russell Turner is, for full disclosure, I coach his son in AAU. Son Darius is a great kid. Really interesting guy. Super bright. Big center when he played Division III basketball. One of the great Division III basketball players of his era. Maybe of any era. Look at his stats. It's crazy. The Hamden Sydney. And he joins me now on the All Ball podcast. Let's welcome him in. He's Russell Turner. He's the head coach of UC Irvine. Of course, they've won four Big West titles. Won a game last year in the NCAA tournament. And kind of an amazing rise to prominence in college basketball. But Russ, you go back. Where did you grow up specifically?
Oh, well, thanks for asking, Doug. It's great to be with you on the pod. I grew up in Roanoke, Virginia, which is a long way from Irvine, but great place to grow up.
So, I have no idea the basketball scene in Roanoke, right? Because I know, I know the DMV, I know there's the Hampton Roads area, yeah. Right? But where exactly is Roanoke, and what's the basketball scene like growing up?
Well, Roanoke is in southwestern Virginia, so it's actually close to West Virginia, and it's closer to Tennessee than it is to northern Virginia, so it's a pretty rural place. But Roanoke's a working-class town. You know, there was a railroad there and a GE factory, and I had great coaches there, and they were actually on my high school team. We had the third-best high school team in the nation my senior year. There were two guys on my team who played in the NBA, and two more played in the NFL, so I was around some really good athletes growing up.
Who?
Well, George Lynch, who everybody in L.A. knows because he was first-round pick of the Lakers, was my high school teammate and went on to North Carolina, won a national title. And then Curtis Blair was my high school teammate, and he played briefly in the NBA with Houston after being one of the leaders on Richmond's team when they were a 15 seed and knocked off number two Syracuse.
Wow, I remember that. That was the first time I heard their nickname was the Spiders, right? People had an acrophobia.
Yeah.
And then who were the NFL guys?
We had some players, you know. We weren't a place that was known to be consistently good, but there were really great players in my class, and so I was fortunate and on a great team that helped me get a lot better.
Who were the football players?
Well, Bernard Basham was one, and he played at Virginia Tech and went on to play in the NFL for a couple of seasons. And another kid was Melvin Davis, who unfortunately passed away when he was really young. But we had just really excellent athletes throughout my high school at that time. It hadn't been the same there since, but I came along at the right – I was in the right place at the right time.
Who was your high school coach?
A guy named Woody Deans. And Coach Deans was the type of high school coach who drove a Suburban and picked everybody up for practice and then took us home and – really invested, you know, more time and energy and love into his job than just about any other high school coach that we knew of at that time. And so he did a great job marketing our team my senior year. We played DeMatha in a huge game in Roanoke and were able to beat them. And in my senior year, we actually also gave Oak Hill Academy their worst loss in their history, because I think people underestimated how good we'd be that year.
And you guys were just a public school? Like Patrick Henry was just a public high school that just happened to have this unbelievable team?
Yeah, we were a neighborhood school. In fact, there was one kid who transferred out who made first team All-State and went on to Virginia Tech. We just happened to have a bunch of guys right from around where I was who were all pretty daggone good. And can't think of anything, you know, that would have been more fortunate for me growing up than that.
So how'd you – now, did you play AAU? Do you guys have the same AAU team? Did you play travel basketball together, or were you just high school?
No, we had it's not like – it wasn't then like it is now. It probably wasn't as big, but we came in second in the national tournament. You know, we thought it was a national championship. Penny Hardaway's team from Memphis beat us, and they had guys who went on to Division I. And I guess we did too, but we weren't nearly as known as they were, so we were kind of a underdog group. So it was fun. It was fun doing all those things. And then most of my teammates from high school, there were several others, went on to great careers in college like I was able to do. You know, I chose the right place and played in Division III, but I had a really good experience doing that.
Okay, so you went to Hampden, Sydney, which is, it's like the 10th oldest school in the country. It's an unbelievable academic institution. But And it actually has like a really unique kind of basketball history as well. And you had a remarkable career. But what was the decision like? Like, did you have D1 offers? Why did you choose Hampden, Sydney?
I had a couple D1 offers. VMI, so that's Virginia Military Institute, for people out here who don't know, offered me. And Wofford was Division II, and they offered me. But none of those schools seemed to be exactly a good fit. You know, I hoped, like a lot of kids, to have a chance to play at a higher level and maybe to walk on or something. So I wasn't sure. I was really young when I graduated. I was only 17 when I graduated. So I think I was probably less mature than maybe I could have been. And the Hampden Sydney coach recruited me really late and probably recruited me harder than anywhere else. And I had some other guys that I knew who were going there, and that's what I chose. But I can't think of a better choice that I've made, even if it wasn't as informed as, you know, maybe I could look back and say it could have been. It was the perfect choice for me because of the coach. And the coach and I were great fits. And Coach Tony Shaver had played at North Carolina under Dean Smith as primarily a backup to Phil Ford. And Coach Shaver's a Hall of Famer in Virginia and had a great career at Hampden Sydney and a great career at William & Mary. So I got an outstanding coaching education being there at Hampden Sydney, where I was a real good fit and one of the best guys.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. Okay, so you're 17. Like, what was the family decision like in terms of college then?
Well, I got an academic scholarship to Hampden Sydney, and that was going to pay a huge chunk of my tuition. That was the reason that place was an option for me. So it was just trying to figure out what would fit right, and it seemed like that would. It was only 2 hours away from home, which at that stage in my life I was comfortable with. And so I made that choice. The thing I remember most is that I had to keep a GPA of 3.3 or higher or I'd lose my scholarship. And so I was scared to death of, you know, failing to meet that requirement and having to come home. And that was really good for me as a student because it forced me to be more serious than I probably otherwise would have been at a young age. And so I had to grow up pretty quickly.
Well, you end up being magna cum laude, right? Like, so you didn't fall below 3.3. Did you have any B's in college?
If I was going to have to go home doing that, I was going to make sure that I did my work and stayed on top of things. And it's like a lot of things for me as a student. As I did it well, I then got better. And, you know, that's some of what I try to tell my guys now. I expect of them, you know, this place is hard at UC Irvine, but once you figure it out, you can also figure out how to do better and better, and more things in your life will open up if you can find that success. That's what
I did. But Hampden Sydney, Virginia it's a town of like 1,400 people, and then the school is like 1,100 students. You went to a high school that, I don't know what it was like then, but now it's like 2,000 people, and Roanoke's a pretty big sized city. Like, what was there any culture shock?
Yeah, there was some, but, you know, if you're from southwestern Virginia, you don't feel, you know, there's much cultural shock doing what I did moving to Hampden Sydney. I mean, it's not like there was no town there. The town of Farmville's close. It didn't feel like you were totally out separated from everybody, but the world was different then. It was a good place for me to spread my wings and grow. You know, if I'd gone to a bigger place, I probably would have felt intimidated in some ways. Right. If I look back on it, you know, really it was a perfect fit for me at the time where I needed to do some maturing and some growing up. And I had great role models to help me with that.
You scored 2,272 points. You were all ODAC four times, all region three times, all tournament team three times, two-time All-American. Did you guys win the championship?
We won conference championships a couple times. My first season at Hampton-Sydney was the school's first trip to the NCAA tournament. So not that different than what we've done here at Irvine. And then my senior year, we advanced in the NCAA tournament a good ways, and I ended up losing to the team that won the title. But my one of the things I'm proudest of is the program continued to get better after I was there, and got all the way to the point where they played for the Division III national championship. So that was cool. I mean, it's cool to be a part of the growth of something at Hampton-Sydney. In some ways, like I feel like I'm part of the growth of something here at Irvine.
Oh, I definitely think you're part of the growth of something at Irvine. I want to get to that. So you get done. You get done playing. By the way, do you want to know, like, you guys lost to Calvin? Is that who you lost to?
No, we lost to Wisconsin Platteville, who was coached by Ryan. Bo Ryan.
Yeah. I don't think they won it that year, though. 92, they lost to Rochester in the semifinals. They won the third place.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Well, I got to get my story straight. I thought they'd won it. I know they were the team that beat Hampton-Sydney in the national championship game a few years later. I think maybe that, you know, you must be right if you looked it up. I know they were number one in the country when we played them in the NCAA tournament.
And it was 92, right? We're talking 1992?
Yeah, 92.
Yeah, 92. 91 they won it. So the year before they won it, they were defending champions.
Okay. So yeah, and I think they were number one ranked in the tournament when we played them, and they beat us.
You mentioned Shavers of Carolina.
Paying attention after we lost.
You mentioned Carolina's Shaver was a Carolina guy. So is that what you guys ran? Did you guys run the Carolina transition game? Did you run a run and jump? Like, how did you guys play?
Yeah, same. Absolutely the Carolina system. The one that, you know, most of the Carolina tree coaches used for a long time, and components of it still exist at Carolina now under Roy Williams. So that was a great education. And my high school coach had modeled our program in our high school after Carolina. You know, Dean Smith was an icon type coach on the East Coast, like John Wooden was out here. And so it was a great education for me to learn that system from a guy who played in it. And, you know, that's at the root of, you know, my coaching experience now. Like we use the same defensive calls in our program at Irvine that we used at Hampton-Sydney and that were used by Dean Smith at Carolina. And some of those are the trapping calls, like you mentioned, with the run and jump.
Yeah. So how'd you score so much if you guys ran so much? I guess you get down the post and they throw it in you, feed you till you burped?
Oh, yeah. I joked that, man, when the ball got to me, it was like throwing the ball out the window. It wasn't coming back. But I shot a really high percentage and never really took dribbles. I had a good feel for, you know, getting crafty shots off around the rim. And, I was fortunate. I was fortunate to play with great passers. The point guards I played with are the guys who, you know, lead the school all time in assists. And I guess I had some part in that, but I was playing with guys who were really good at getting the ball to me in scoring positions. So I just did my thing. And
so you were a year. So did you have an opportunity to play, or you just decided you wanted to go into coaching? Like, what's that? Because you coached there for a year before moving on to Wake. What was that decision like to coach?
Yeah, well, you know, I did want to play, but the world was a lot different when I graduated in '92. I actually had a couple of offers to go overseas, but that was in the middle of the first Gulf War, and one of the offers I had was in Israel, and I was a little bit uncertain about that, and, you know, not nearly as worldly then as I feel like I am now. And so I decided to go on the teaching and coaching track. And what I did right after graduation was I went to Rome, Georgia, and I taught in a boarding school there and I coached. So I used to joke that You know, I coach, I teach English in Rome, but it was Rome, Georgia, where I spent my first year out of Hampton, Sydney, and worked with a great head coach there and thought maybe I'd be a high school coach or a Division III coach. Then I had a chance to go back to Hampton, Sydney as an assistant, which was a great opportunity to work with the coach who had coached me. That seemed too good to pass up, so I did that. And then within a year of that, Dave Odom at Wake Forest offered to hire me in large part because I had been a big part of his son's development at Hampton, Sydney. I was there when we started recruiting his son to Hampton, Sydney, and then the year I was an assistant there, he was a sophomore, and I helped him kind of emerge through a rough freshman year. And Dave needed to hire a restricted earnings coach at that time, and so he hired me. And, you know, I was, I think, 22 or 23 years old at the time I went to Wake Forest, and we had Tim Duncan. So just an incredible stroke of luck for me in my career.
What was Tim Duncan like?
Oh, man, same as you probably expect. He was, at that time, he was only 18 years old. He had finished his freshman year and only 18. So he's very young, but obviously an incredible talent who had done better in his freshman year at Wake before I got there than people had thought. And then the year I was there was the year that he emerged as a sophomore into what was perceived to be the best player in the country. But he was quiet. He was unassuming. He was thoughtful. And he was a great teammate, just a defensive and rebounding anchor, and felt like on any given night we could win because we could control the tempo because of him. We could rebound because of him, and we'd have a chance in a close game down the stretch. And we got hot with that team his sophomore year and won the ACC for the first time in like 35 years for Wake Forest. So it was a great, great experience for me.
Was that when Randolph Childress, who did he fall down?
Yes. Everybody remembers Randolph, but Tim was a freshman that year, or a sophomore that year.
Sophomore,
so that was
sophomore.
The year that Tim really emerged.
Yeah, and then you guys went to the NCAA tournament and went to the Sweet 16, right? Like you beat Chattanooga, Iowa, and then you got pummeled by Kentucky.
That was the year that your guys from Oklahoma State beat us.
Well, that was 95. That was sophomore year was 95. That's right. Yeah, 95 was A&T beat St. Louis, then lost to Oklahoma State. Big Country versus Tim Duncan. What do you remember about that game?
Yep. Well, I remember Jason Scare, who you probably remember, nobody else does, banked in a three from the wing. So it was like a luck shot. And then I think he might have even made another one later that were backbreakers. But we were heavily favored in that game. We were on a huge win streak. We were the number one seed. But in close games in the NCAA tournament, you know, a player or two here and there can change it. And Oklahoma State outplayed us. Is what I remember, and that was just a huge disappointment to everybody at Wake on the heels of a historic run that we had made. So it felt like we had, you know, done something incredible, but then fallen short when the chips were most down. So it was really a disappointing loss. But then we also thought we were going to be back. And, you know, with Tim coming back, we thought we were going to be good, and we were close to being a number one seed type the next year, but we never really made the run in the NCAA tournament that we all hoped to make.
What'd you learn from Dave Odom?
Oh man, Dave was a great leader and an incredible contrast to the style of play that we had used in what I say is the Carolina system at Hampton, Sydney. He couldn't have been really more different than that. And so those styles in opposition was just a great education for me. But Dave had a toughness and an underdog mentality about him, and a leadership ability and set of qualities that were difference making. He was just outstanding in his ability to drive and focus our team. He focused on fundamentals. You know, I say all the time, pass and catch the ball. And Dave used to say that over and over again, which seems, you know, so simple that it's almost stupid, but we worked on passing and catching the ball, and were great because we could control games and control tempo. And we did it real differently, you know, with a slow pace than the Carolina system where you're trying to play fast. So it was just great to work for him. I'm so thankful for what he's, you know, taught me in my career.
It's interesting because my brother actually was talking about passing and catching. He always mentioned that Sean Miller talks about passing and catching a ton. And so obviously, you know, I get to coach your son some, and you know, when you, I remember I moved out here to Orange County. This is like back home like 2 years ago, and I took my son to a workout, and they're doing Euro steps and all this stuff. And I was like, well, where's the, so the guy who's running the workout's a great dude. He works out NBA guys.
Yeah.
And he's like, what do you think? And I was like, well, where's the passing and the catching and the pivoting? He's like, should we do that?
Right.
Yeah. He's like, yeah. Like, and it's the, it's just like math, right? Like you can't do high level math if you don't know how to do addition, subtraction, multiplication, right? Like you can't do radio unless you know kind of the X's and O's of executing radio. But but somehow the simplicity, and I know that I want to get to coaching with Mike Montgomery. He's big simplicity and execution, right? But just the simplicity of like, hey, passing and catching. Like I do this thing with kids, and I do it with when I teach coach older guys, where I say, you know, what's the golden rule? And they always say, you know, do unto others as they do unto you. Like, all right, well, give them a good fucking pass too, right? It's the same thing, right? Do you want a bad pass?
Yeah.
Do you want one that's below your knees? Like, no. Well, like, give somebody a good pass. If you want to get a good pass, give them a good pass, because if you can't pass, you can't catch cleanly. It's going to hurt your shooting percentage. You don't shoot the ball well. Your coach's not going to let you shoot, and you change everything you do. But it is, it's interesting that he's a big passing and catching guy. Why you left and you went to Stanford? Was that when Dave left? Why did you leave Wake in 2000?
No. My story in coaching is interesting for this. My wife graduated from medical school at Wake, and she was number one in her class in medical school. And so she basically got to choose where she would match as a resident. And the matching process means that, you know, the place that you pick and picks you is where you go. She chose as her top two choices University of California, San Francisco, and Stanford. So we knew at the end of the season we were going to move to California. We just didn't know which school she was going to be at for her residency. So I picked up and moved out here with her and gave up what was my dream job at Wake Forest in a huge gamble, career-wise. And, you know, that was not probably something that made sense to a lot of people. And looking back on it, it's just incredibly fortunate how it worked out for me, because I ended up on Monty's staff at Stanford, but that was only after I was briefly coaching women's basketball at University San Francisco. I was an assistant coach for the women's team there before Monty hired me to come on to Stanford in like an administrative assistant role, which is not much more than a secretary.
And So your wife is like, hey, we're moving to California. Deal with it.
We made the decision to roll the dice there. You know, I thought that the level she was operating at in her career was even higher than where I was at that point in mine. And so I probably had some overconfidence. I'd go out to California and find something good, and did the best I could, and ended up somehow through another great stroke of luck at Stanford, where they had a team that was nearly number one in the country, or was number one in the country the first year I was with them.
Who'd you coach with, and how long at San Francisco?
Mary Heil Netfu, who's the all-time leading scorer at San Francisco in women's basketball. She hired me when her husband retired, and she and her husband had been the co-head coaches, and so she hired me to be her assistant when he left. It was a weird, you know, sort of situation, but it was a good situation, you know, given the fact that we were trying to live in San Francisco. I need to make some cash. The experience coaching the women was good for me. I enjoyed it. It was unusual. It was foreign in some ways, but I'm glad that I did it. And then, you know, I had the opportunity pretty quickly after getting that job to then go to Stanford. So I did.
So you're at Stanford, and then what was Monty like? You know, like now you've you know, you had Tony Shaver and the Carolina background. You have Dave Odom, and now you're out West Coast. Monty's a different. He's just a different dude, completely different style. What was your takeaway from coaching with Monty?
Well, I mean, yeah, Monty is a different guy, but in a lot of great ways. Like the style that he has was formed, I guess, by Judd Heathcoat, and through, you know, the time he was in Montana with those guys, and that's, again, very different from what Dave was at Wake Forest, and very different than what the Carolina system was. So it was just an additional education for me to see what made them good. They were good very, very differently than the two other places I'd been. And, you know, Monty's a tough guy to work for in terms of him being really smart and really demanding. And there couldn't have been a challenge that more excited me at the time than trying to figure out how to make it there. You know, I had to learn what he thought and what he wanted and learn this new offense that, you know, everybody there thought was so incredibly difficult. It was a great immersion for me. But the thing that I saw pretty quickly is that we won there at Stanford more because of our defense than our offense, which had been the same case at Wake. And that's been a huge influence on me. So I think I learned a tremendous amount from Mike. And I'm so grateful to him because, he told me the first time I met him, he said, Russ, you know, I probably won't ever be able to hire you here at Stanford. And I thought that to be right. But then somehow I lucked up and ended up with him and then getting carried by him into the NBA, which is another incredible break.
So you guys go to the NBA, and you're in the NBA for 6 years. What was that experience like?
Yeah, just unbelievably positive for me. Going with Mike was just a great, great opportunity. The program at Stanford had been so stable for so long that we didn't really anticipate a change like that. I was incredibly impressed with Mike taking that risk in his own career. It felt a little bit like the risk I took in moving cross country, but he just moved into a different industry in the NBA. And immediately I wanted to go with him. I wanted that challenge. I wanted to see what I could learn there and do there. And he gave me a great opportunity as an assistant coach because he had me doing everything that the other assistants were doing, even though as a basketball coach in the NBA, I wasn't qualified yet because I hadn't been there. So the learning curve was incredibly steep. And trying to coach NBA players when you've not had exposure to the NBA is a tough sled because those guys are the most intelligent players in the world. They've been coached by the best guys consistently throughout their careers. So if you're not sure of what you're doing, you're not going to make much progress. So I had to get up that curve really quickly. But I love the NBA. And anybody who would coach in the NBA would love it.
What's it like to coach Baron Davis? Because I always feel like Baron, it was a guy who was maybe a little too smart for his own good, right? Like he was very, very, and like he should have been a first ballot Hall of Famer. Like he has that level of talent, but there's just these gaping holes in his career resume. What was that experience like?
I mean, it was, exciting and rewarding to coach a guy as talented and smart as Baron is. You know, the best players with the best minds are the ones that are the biggest challenges to coach. And that's true whether it's a guy like Baron or a guy like Steph Curry, who I've had the great fortune to coach, or a guy like Tim Duncan, who I've had the great fortune to coach. You got to try to figure out how to connect with those guys and have a positive influence on them. And it's always different. I learned more from Baron maybe than anybody, because he is so thoughtful, he's opinionated, and he's expressive. So watching his career unfold in the time I was with him was really just fun. It was fun to be a part of. I mean, every day was different with him, but he taught me a lot. I mean, he taught me more about pick and roll basketball from the perspective of the big guys than any other player that I can think of. And, a huge part, as Doug, if you're handling the ball in a pick and roll and you're working with a good operator who's setting picks, you're going to be really good. And I think that's one thing I learned from Baron, is how to teach guys better what to do in a lot of different situations. So I'm grateful, to everything I experienced in coaching with him. And like a lot of people, I also probably think there could have been more for him, and maybe. And that's not a criticism, but that's sort of the way you feel about every guy. I mean, can you get more out of this whole thing? And, I love the time I spent with Baron. I got some great, great memories of the 2007 team, the We Believe team that we shared together.
Yeah, that was an amazing, amazing group. Don, you stuck out, you hung on through Don Nelson became the next coach. What was Nelly like?
Man, Nelly, just a fascinating person Nelly is. He's got if there ever is a basketball genius, I'd say he'd be one of them. There may be a few, But in terms of having the experience and knowledge and insight, I mean, he said and did things that I never would have thought, would make any sense. And somehow there was always a nugget I could get from watching Nelly. And we had so much fun. I mean, the 4 years I spent with Nelly were the funnest years I've had in my life, because he knew that in the NBA, you had to be really good, but you also had to make it through the season. And there were components of making it through the season that were related to having a good time. So we got that right. And then watching him in the playoffs in 2007, I got a glimpse of him at his very best. And that was fascinating. I mean, to see how well a guy could do it on the coaching side of this business. He did it that well then. I don't know that we were the most consistent staff, but that short period of time, we were the best I've ever seen.
What specifically about it was so good?
Well, Nelly's ability to see things from the player's perspective and then apply his incredible experience is just different. And it's hard to really describe that quickly. There's all these little things though that he would say and that we would work on. Like he would say, if you switch, you must deny. And that's obvious. But I never heard anybody say that. He would say you have to flop against a flopper, which also is obvious, but nobody really would think that way or teach that. We would always attack mismatches with the small and the big. And so that's a Nelly, he figured that out before everybody else did, I guess.
Right.
There's
right.
a million little things like that that you've got to sort of experience to understand. And the thing that made Nelly so great is we try anything. Like, he would try anything. And real often the things we tried didn't work, but also real often the things we tried did work. So I came out of the number of years and games with Nelly feeling like I'd experienced more different things than were even possible. So it was great. I mean, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed the time that we spent together for all sorts of different little reasons like that.
Steph Curry walks in the door as a rookie. What did you think? Your initial impression was what?
Well, when we drafted him, there was not a consensus that Steph Curry was going to be a great NBA player. Nelly was adamant that he could be a superstar. And so we picked him, I think it was seventh, but there had to be 3 point guards taken before him for him to fall to us. And that's what the whole organization was hoping would happen. So that's just an incredible story of luck there. I think it was Tyreke Evans, Johnny Flynn, and Ricky Rubio were all selected before Steph. And so when he came, he was physically underdeveloped for the NBA. He was young looking, and he was also a guy that seemed a little green, for the business of the NBA. But much like Tim Duncan is, he's an incredible teammate. He's got a great brain for the game, and he has a desire to be good that's just different. So watching him try to figure it out was fascinating. We had a kid on the team, I say kid, I'm thinking like college, we had a guy on the team named Anthony Morrow that year that we all said was the best shooter in the NBA at that time. He made it out of Georgia Tech. He was undrafted. We took him out of summer league. But he was also from that part of the country. So we had a group of young guys who worked every day, and Morrow was able to shoot at a level that was close to Chris Mullin. And Chris Mullin was, of course, the best shooter in the organization at the time. And so Steph, becoming what he became, started then, and I got to see that early and watch him work to become the type of ball handler and shooter that he's now become. And just having been witness to where that all started is something I'm grateful for. I'll never forget when we went to Madison Square Garden the first time, that was the arena Steph most wanted to play and play well in. Nelly was so hard on Steph that game. I think he played like 4 minutes or something in that game. Steph just wouldn't allow that sort of setback to affect him negatively. Affected him positively. It made him drive and improve and work harder. And that's always how it goes with guys who end up exceeding expectations the way Steph has.
All right, so Russ, you're in the NBA. You're coaching with Don Nelson. What made you want to get into college coaching as a head coach?
Well, every coach, I think, aspires to being a head coach at some level. And I was in an entry position in the NBA because it appeared that our team was going to get sold and there was going to be a lot of change. And, you know, the opportunity at Irvine was available, and the AD at the time, Mike Izzy, and I had worked together at Stanford. So the opportunity to possibly come here, establish a program and an identity and have a place like this to be with my family was just really appealing. And I'm glad I made the move now. You know, the first couple of years I wasn't as certain about that because leaving the NBA is a big change and a big move. And not many guys who get to that level decide to go another place. But I think that's been a good decision for me.
So you get to – when you took the job, had you been to UCI's campus? I don't know. I don't remember how it worked in terms of your interview.
You know, I knew that the coach that was in place before me was at the end of his contract, and I knew there was a possibility of an opening. So, yeah, I made the drive through campus, but I didn't really know that much about it. I knew mainly the AD was new and was trying to establish, you know, something. And you know, now looking back, we've done everything at that time we set out to do. But it was a leap of faith a little bit, and it was one on his part, it's one on my part. And I'm glad we both made that leap, and I'm glad it's worked out the way it has. But I wasn't very familiar with Irvine or the Big West when I made the jump.
So, I've always thought you get to that campus, and look, it's an incredible campus.
Now it is.
Right, you're right. But it's one of those deals where I'm sure you showed up and they have a nice arena. And, you know, the facilities, you know, the locker rooms are okay or whatever. But at that level, and I know you're coming from the NBA, so it's just a hard evaluation. But you had to, on some level, think, okay, like, how are they not winning here? I mean, I'm just wondering, like, what do you remember about going through your head about your initial impressions of UCI?
Well, I remember thinking that the potential was outstanding because of the location, because of the quality of the education in the UC system. It didn't make sense to me why they hadn't been better in the recent history. It was hard to figure that out from the perspective I had, which was a really limited perspective. But I also thought when I looked at the league that because the only team that was going to make the tournament was the tournament winner, there was a fair amount of parity. And that's proven to be true. You know, the Big West rep to the NCAA tournament has been different so many times recently that every school has a shot. That was initially my thought process because I knew that UCI had never made the NCAA tournament. So I thought that was obvious to be the ultimate goal at the time, along with trying to build sustainable success. But I thought it would be doable. And it turns out all those thoughts at the time were right. But the journey it's been, you know, it's not been smooth. It was one that we had to work really hard to, you know, make changes gradually and make some changes real significantly right away. So it's been good. I mean, but there's no job like this that's easy. This one has a lot to it, though, and I still think there's room for us to grow.
What was that first team like?
Well, we were a veteran team, so when I came here, they made me believe that we were set up to win right away. And I can see now, looking back, why they said that, because we had talent. We had, you know, some veteran guys, some veteran guards, but you know, everybody says the culture wasn't there. We didn't have a tightly knit group. We didn't have a group that was really competitive like we are now, that was really committed like we are now. So we were a lot further from winning, I think, than I understood then, or that the people who brought me here understood then. And so we had to make some changes, and we had to develop an identity. None of that was in place. The identity was not in place here. And so I think that's the most critical thing in a college program, is having an identity for your program that fits your campus, your university, your community. At this stage, we've got that, and I want to guard that very carefully.
So how did you go about like implementing that? Like what are the steps? You know, if somebody's going to build it, and you inherit somebody else's program, a veteran team, what are the steps that you took in order to build kind of that culture?
You know, I can look back and name them easily now, but it was maybe a little bit harder to see this at the time. the first thing I wanted was to have guys who wanted to be here and would be bought in to the things we were asking to do. And then we had to decide, you know, how we're going to build the team. Were we going to try to get transfers, whether they be from, you know, JUCO situations or other places, or were we going to recruit high school kids and try to commit to player development? That was the route we chose. We're going to take high school kids and be a player development type program. And we had to, you know, sort of set out what we envisioned our style of play to be. When I got here, I was the biggest guy on the team. That's one thing I remember. I mean, I was the biggest guy in the program, and we set out very quickly to change that, in part based on what I'd seen at Stanford and Wake Forest, and my thinking that we could commit to that with high academic standards and make it work. So we did that, and then we hit some, you know, some singles early on in recruiting by getting guys who were undervalued, and then we pretty quickly hit a couple home runs with some of the big guys that we got. And when we did that, we turned the corner.
Who was the guy? Who was the turn the corner recruit? I mean, I think Mamadou is the one that people would point to. I remember you getting better. You know, I think it was your third year. You know, I thought, you know, Will Davis was.
You're on the right track. You know, Eric Wise was the best player when I got here, and so he transferred after my first year to USC. And ended up having a really good career.
He played
there.
For my dad. Yeah, he played for my dad.
Okay,
undersized big guy.
Right, right. And the guy that we got, because Eric left when he left, was Will Davis. And around the same time, we got a kid named Mike Best, who was a 6'10 kid who was underdeveloped but became very good. We got a commitment from a point guard named Alex Young, who nobody had ever heard of. And that kid had no offers. He was from a small town, Phoenix, Oregon. And that kid became the all-time leader in assists and wins here at UC Irvine. So that was really the group that that we brought in that got us going. But the guys that we had at the beginning and that we kept from the team that Pat Douglas had were equally important. One of those guys on my staff now, Mike Wilder, all our fans remember him because of his afro. But Mike became, you know, the embodiment of what we want our program to be in terms of being a committed guy who gets a lot better and figures out a way to play a role because he's really competitive. He did all those things, ended up being an all-conference guy at Power Four. He's only 6'1". So those guys get a lot of the credit. And then the recruiting class that changed it all was when we got Mamadou. And we didn't just get Mamadou in that class. We got Giannis Dimokopoulos, who was a 7'2" Greek kid. And we got Luke Nelson, who's from England, and he went on to be the player of the year in our league. So that class was the one that really changed, I think, everybody's outlook about what we could be.
2015, you know, you guys actually kind of stumbled into the Big West tournament, right? Like, you lost to Santa Barbara in the Thunderdome. You got blown out by Davis last game of the year. You got beat 19 at UC Davis. Right? And, yeah, you got to go dodge the cow patties and go play UC Davis. And so you go to Anaheim as a team that had really played, you know, great basketball in the kind of the middle of the year. What do you remember about that tournament that your first Big West tournament that you won? You beat Riverside. You had that war against Santa Barbara that you won in overtime, and then you ultimately beat Hawaii to go to the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, you know, so what I remember. We had been injured a lot that year, and the previous year to that, we had won the conference championship in the regular season, but had gotten upset in the tournament by Cal Poly. And so those experiences are impactful for programs and for players. And so I think all of our team knew that we needed to gear up for the tournament. I mean, we've always known that, but having actually experienced it is different. So we knew we got a fresh start with that tournament. But we knew there were teams in our league who were as good as we were. And Santa Barbara's a great example. I mean, I vividly remember the semifinal game that year. Alan Williams, who's enjoyed an NBA career of significance now, you know, took a shot that would have beat us. It was a tie game, and he shot it just before the buzzer in regulation. And it's a shot he usually makes, and he had to shoot it over Mamadou, so he missed it. But if that goes in, then, you know, we don't do that year what we did. Which is kind of the way the Big West goes, but we found a way to win that game in overtime. We played with, you know, we played, made some great plays in overtime of that game to beat Santa Barbara, and then withstood a really substantial barrage from Hawaii. I think we were down 13-1 or something like that in the championship game. So we showed some toughness, some resilience in coming back in that game and kind of stretching it out towards the end of what was a really tightly contested game the whole way, the way you'd expect a conference tournament to be. And then the elation I remember everybody feeling to have accomplished the goal that we had all set out for, you know, and we had made clear in our recruiting and we had, you know, named consistently was, you know, what we were chasing. To accomplish that was really a special feeling, not just for our team and our staff, but for all the supporters of UC Irvine. I'll never forget the way people rushed the floor at that time and just how it all felt. It felt like we'd really accomplished something.
You guys almost beat Louisville that year. I mean, it was a two point game.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I knew that we would have a chance because when we had Mamadou, we had a chance against any team, especially if we could keep from turning the ball over and keep the tempo, you know, normal for us, because he's so difficult to play against a person like Mamadou with his size. So I thought that he'd be a factor against Louisville, and I didn't think that he was going to get, you know, crazy foul calls. And all that kind of played out the way we thought. Louisville was not a very good three-point shooting team. They relied heavily on points around the rim, and we did just about as good a job as anybody preventing those type of points. So the whole key for us was to be able to take care of the ball and respond to the different types of defensive looks Louisville was going to throw at us. It had been helpful to me to have played against Patino's teams when I was at Wake Forest, to have coached against them. We had a great week of preparation, and our guys went into that event thinking that we could win games, not just one, but thinking we could win games. And had we been able to beat Louisville, we'd have had a chance in the next round, too.
Yeah. Okay, so the Mamadou thing is interesting, right? Like, if he was 10 years older, he's in the NBA, and he's on somebody's bench or something with it. Like, it's really crazy how fast the league has changed, where, like, he couldn't find a team.
Yeah, it was tough, you know, seeing that for him because of how badly he wanted it and how hard he worked to try to create that opportunity for himself. But then he just couldn't make it fit. And, you know, Mamadou's now playing professionally in different places in the world. He's doing well. He's successful. And I do expect he's going to come back and graduate at some point from Irvine. But I wanted that badly for him. And I understood the NBA, too. I mean, the NBA was changing towards, you know, more of a spread game. Mamadou's pick-and-roll defensive ability was, you know, something that people zeroed in on as a weakness of his that could be overcome by NBA players. And so he didn't make it. And he even struggled to catch on in the D-League, which surprised me some based on what they told me the team that took him. I thought they were going to be committed to him for longer than they were. But Mamadou is a guy you sort of have to figure out how to work with and use. And we did that here. We did it well. That's to his credit. But unfortunately, it just didn't work out for him in the NBA. And like you said, when the rules were different and the emphasis were different in the NBA, he would have made it. But in 2015, he couldn't.
You had a kid who was about as remarkable a college player as anyone has ever had. And I don't think most of the mainstream America knows about Jonathan Galloway. Defensive player of the year, like 3 years in a row in the Big West?
Yeah, three in a row. And I didn't think it was close any of those 3 years. That's how good he was.
And what's crazy about it, the way he... Yeah, so he's 6'10", 235. And he's from, like... The way he plays, if I said, like, where do you think this guy's from? And, like, in L.A., and you would pick any sort of the blue-collar spots. Like, he's from Brentwood, which is probably the nicest part of Los Angeles, right, to live in. How did you...
He's not from Brentwood in Los Angeles.
Oh, he's from Brentwood in...
He's from Northern California. The Brentwood in the Bay Area.
So is Brentwood in Northern California as nice as Brentwood in Southern California?
Nah, man, it's real different.
tell me about when you first saw him. When you first saw him, what do you remember?
You know, I remember his motor. He clearly wanted badly to be really good, and seemed then, when I first saw him, sort of frustrated that he wasn't better at a lot of the things that he, you know, people would have wanted him to be able to do. But I remember, you know, when I got to know him, he's just an incredibly hard worker. He had size and desire that were different, you know, that we could typically get. You know, when I say size, you know, he was just a rangy, athletic kid who we thought could develop into either a center or a power forward. And I recruited him as a power forward, but one of the things that made him so good was that he could defend bigger guys or smaller guys, really could defend anybody. And rebounded, you know, getting a guy like that to buy into a role that's not glamorous is often really difficult. But with Jonathan, it wasn't, man. There's never been a better teammate than him. I told some people at the end of last year that, you know, I hadn't seen a kid have an impact like he's had since I coached Tim Duncan at Wake. And I say that because John just impacted our team's culture. He impacted how, you know, good guys our group, you know, all wanted to be, and he changed the way we competed every day. So he's just really good, man. As a college player, he's just really, really good. And he just signed a big deal in Denmark. He went to a really high level professionally, so I'm happy for him. I wouldn't be surprised if one day he ends up in the NBA.
Totally. I mean, he can defend the rim, he can rebound, he knows his role, and he's a great teammate. Like, I want him. I mean, he can't play for you, play at Irvine, be a success if you're not a smart kid. What's it like to pull that upset? I mean, 13-4 upset. I thought you guys were underseeded, but you get K-State, and obviously one of their best players doesn't play, but you know, you beat a really good Kansas State team, and this is a long time coming for you, a long time coming for your program. And, you know, it was a tie game at halftime, too. It's one of those games where it wasn't like you led the whole way and they were super tight and made a comeback late. Like, you guys were challenged, and they played pretty well. What's it like to finally win an NCAA tournament game?
Yeah, it was great. Just super impressed with my players, how competitively they approached the game and then competed in it. It was a really good game. You know, we knew it was a good matchup for us, especially with them missing Wade. And we had an advantage because we'd played them the year before early in the season, and they had drilled us in Manhattan, in part because we were at that time just a really inexperienced group of players. And the guys we had sort of, you know, grown up for 2 years. And the guys they had were all also still the same, but probably didn't fully respect us the way maybe they would have if they had never seen us, and based on our record. We got down 10 early in the first half, and it looked like it could go the way the game in Manhattan had. But we fought back and made a bunch of tough plays and made some defensive stands. And we were really fortunate because their best guard got 2 fouls early. And I thought we did a great job of drawing both of those foul calls. And that was significant. And then by the time we got into halftime, our guys were confident. And so we thought we would have a chance to win the game. The game had unfolded the way we expected it would. And then we went out and just really played great basketball in the second half to beat them.
You're a guy who is unafraid of interacting with fans, of interacting with other players, and in the Oregon game, you know, you're getting onto one of their players, and obviously it came back to the press conference. If you could do it all over again, would you do it again?
You know, hey, Doug, great question, and I love what you do because you're a straight talker and you say what you think. So there's not anything out of bounds with anything you ask me relative to this. You know, I really regret the way the whole thing showed up in the media because it took away from what our players did by winning that, you know, winning the game before and accomplishing what we accomplished this year. There's no worse feeling as a coach than when you draw negative attention towards anything relative to your team, your players, your organization, your university. That was the worst feeling defeat as a coach I've ever had. So, and I should also say, you know, if I offended people, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. but I don't intend to coach much differently. There were a number of, you know, unusual circumstances that led to that all, you know, appearing the way it did and then also being portrayed the way it was. And I'm not trying to make myself into any kind of victim. You know, here's what I do, Doug, and I think you could probably appreciate this. In the first half of games when we're on defense, I'm like a sixth defender with my voice and my activity on the sideline. I don't apologize for that. I think that's something that's been a part of us being really good. In this game, what I did was I, instead of using the kid's name, which was King, I used the word Queen. And as a leader, I should have been able to recognize the danger in that, and I didn't. But the way that whole thing played out also really surprised me. It felt like I got named and shamed as a homophobe or a misogynist, and it wasn't any of that. I really don't believe that. I understand why people perceived it that way because of the education stuff that I've done since then. And so I won't ever make that mistake again. But your question about would I do it over? Yeah, sure, would do that differently because I'd never want that to come on in our team or our university. But I don't intend to compete much differently. I'd like to be a better leader. I'd like to say that I could recognize moving forward that changing the kid's name the way I did would be perceived the way it was, because I don't think that was unfair to be perceived that way. But I do think it was just a tough scenario.
I can just imagine, like, you know, you get done with a game, like, and having lost, like, look, I've lost in tournament three times, and every time, you know, my last year was the Elite Eight, and didn't matter Elite Eight or the second round, like, everybody thinks they're going to win the tournament. Like, that's just the way it is. Like, that's how we're all wired. We think we're going to win this game, then we're going to go win a couple more games, then we're going to come more games. Right, and then all of a sudden, like, your whole season, which is basically a year, and all everything, it's like, it's over. There's no more games, no more practice, it's over. And there's this really, every locker room silent. There's the seniors are crying. You know, and then all of a sudden,
the
like,
coach
okay,
to figure out the right things to say.
Right. And then they're like, hey, coach, you got to go out. Right. Okay, coach, you got to go into the press conference. So you go from the final score was not indicative of that game because that was a close game. And then they kind of ran a fever late and they put you guys away. But then they go, hey, coach, come up there. And like, you know, I'm sure you talk about the game. I'm going to talk about the game and what happened in our team, and now all of a sudden you get these questions about it, and yeah, it wasn't.
Well, no, I'll tell you, I didn't even get a question about it. That's what's interesting about the whole thing. You know, I'd had some really good media exchanges in the NCAA tournament that drew, you know, positive attention towards us. And in this case, it was the last question the guy asked me, and he didn't ask me about the word I'd use or anything. I told him all of it because he asked me what Louis King and I were talking about in the handshake line. And what I tried to describe was how the whole conversation came about. And the kid King was great in the handshake line because we had been attacking him. He was our best player. We'd been attacking him and trying to make it hard for him. And we talked briefly about that. He kind of thanked me for the things I said and the way we did it. And it was a really positive exchange. That's what I was trying to describe to the media. But what I did was I revealed too many details about what had happened. And then the media seized on those details in a way that surprised me. You know, live and learn. I should have known better. I think that I try to be open and honest with the media. And sometimes that can create trust. And then other times that creates vulnerability. And I didn't realize how vulnerable I had made myself and what we were doing. But I'm at a point now where I'm kind of okay with all of it, other than that I offended people. You know, I'm okay with the fact that I made such a mistake because I know that I'll be a better coach because of it.
You've had some opportunities that have come your way, one back east. There's been other talk of other jobs out west. You know, your wife, as you point out, she's a physician at UC Irvine. What's your thought process? Because, you know, when you moved to California, it was, hey, I'm following her. Now she's entrenched as a physician. How does that work with you now, considering you're both successful? You know, when you moved out of here originally, she was the successful one. Now you're both successful. You're finally carrying your end of the bargain. How does that work with you?
Well, hey, I appreciate you asking it like that because, you know, my wife and I are good partners. And what I do is an identity, not just a job. And that's become more apparent and clear to me the longer I've been here. Like the longer, you know, I'm at Irvine, the more connected and a part of this place I feel. And I feel pretty special feelings about the way we built our program and what we now have here. As I've been recruited in, you know, by other schools, what I've asked myself each time is, what's better there than what I have, or is it even better there than where I am? And each time, you know, it's come down to that for me. Recently, the answer's been, I got it better here. I got it better here at Irvine. And you know, I'm not doing this for the reasons a lot of people probably might most think. I love having an impact in this community. I love the players I get to work with, and love being a part of their lives, and I love the success we've created, because I think the success we've created means we can have impact on this university's, you know, pride or unity or togetherness or whatever. That's special. So I try to focus on that and not on what might be out there that's better. And I think that's healthy for me. I just signed a 6-year deal here, and if I can coach all the way through that, then that means my son would graduate from high school here, and we've had a great run, and my family's happy. So that's meaningful.
Okay, Tim Duncan's the best player you've ever coached. I mean, I don't think there's anybody would argue that. Second best player you've ever coached?
Steph Curry. And it might be true that Steph could overtake Tim, even though I know that that's not a popular opinion. I think that, you know, having the chance to coach Steph when he was a rookie in the NBA was special. And he wasn't a great player then the way he's become. But the similarities between Tim and Steph are remarkable in terms of they're both being undervalued early in their career. They're both being, you know, physically underdeveloped for a good little while. And, you know, then also them being great teammates and just great thinkers of the game, and guys who just continue to get better. Those two are easy as 1 and 2 or 1 and 1A. After that, it gets pretty hard.
All right, how about this one? One of the great things about the NBA is these guys are amazing. Like, they're really amazing. And I'm friendly with a bunch of NBA assistants, and, you know, they'll talk about, you know, sometimes, you know, good defense and you just tip your cap. What's the best performance you remember sitting there watching going like, damn, that we didn't actually play bad. That guy just gave us 30, 40, or 50. Do you remember one?
Yeah, there were many of those. Folks in Southern California will appreciate me mentioning this one. There was a night Brian Scalabrine had his career high in Oakland. And Brian Scalabrine looked like Larry Bird that night. And there were multiple nights like that in the NBA where a guy that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily think of as an all-star level player could come out and just be dominant for periods of time. That was one of the best things about the NBA, the number of great players that could do that. You know, I mentioned Scalabrine, but there were many others. I mean, there were sometimes guys that, you know, wouldn't even hear of that would have great nights. I love the fact that, you know, during the years we weren't very good at Golden State, we had guys come from the D League and develop. And we used to joke with Nelly, because Nelly would bring a guy up from the D League, and he'd fly in, he'd join the team, and Nelly would tell him before the game, I'm going to play you tonight, and I expect you to get 10 shots up. And no other coach would do that, but Nelly would say that to the kid to put him on the spot and see if his confidence could emerge. And then we had a bunch of guys from those opportunities become NBA players for a long time. So that was great. I mean, there was just so many great things about the NBA. It's hard to list them all.
Awesome stuff. Last thing, when somebody plays against a Russell Turner coach team, what should they walk away saying?
It was hard to score. we've had a great run now for multiple years of being one of the best defensive field goal percentage teams in the country. And that's really hard to do at the mid-major level. But I think that our teams are tough, and we're well-prepared, and we're smart. And so we are going to make you have a tough night. And
what is it like in terms of
if you were to break down for somebody, and like, you know, without a whiteboard or whatever, the basics of your defensive philosophy that's allowed you to be so good. I mean, obviously you have good players and kids like that, you know, like we talked about, but what philosophically, what is it that you do that's been so incredibly successful? Like, your defensive rating last year was 27th out of 353 teams. That's outstanding. It's outstanding. And you played a really tough schedule as well. So what is, philosophically, what defensively do you like to do?
You know, I think we keep it relatively simple. I mean, we protect the rim better than anyone. We do that by flowing shot blockers at the ball anytime the ball attacks the rim. And then we play well together when we do that. Better than most any team in college basketball, we focus on personnel tendencies of our opponents, and we take away easy baskets. I mean, you're not going to get easy baskets against us at the rim. And I also feel like we do an incredible job of contesting three-point shots. You know, I think we fouled three times against three-point shooters against Kansas State in the NCAA tournament, and we still won. Even giving up those 9 free throws, and that's one of the things I think we do well. We contest three-point shots. I mean, we work hard to make sure that you do not feel comfortable shooting three-point shot against us. And we've been outstanding at the rim. So that combination, rim defense, three defense, and personnel tendencies with the ability to adjust and play both man and zone, I think that's a critical component a lot of coaches miss, because some teams don't function well against one or the other. And if you can do both, then you give yourself an advantage. I think all those things came into play for us to beat the Big 12 champs in the NCAA tournament. You know, we played possessions of 2-3 zone, and we played a bunch of possessions in that game of a diamond and one.
Hmm. Yeah, the old diamond one's awesome. My dad used to use that all the time. Of course, Bill Self, he likes the triangle and two. And I always feel like when people use the term junk defense, it's because they don't really have an offense for it, right? So they're like, it's a junk defense. Like, yeah, but it worked, so... You know, I mean,
yeah, hey, there's all kinds of creative defenses. You know, I think it's a little bit more of that. I mean, you could play a defense that's unusual, but it takes away the rim and takes away the threes and makes guys who aren't the best scorers take the shots, and that's pretty good defense.
Well, listen, it's been great to get to know you so far. Can't wait to see your new team this year. But congrats on what's been a remarkable career, and look forward to talking in the future.
Yeah, thanks, man. And we do have a good team coming back, so I hope that all the Hoop fans that are listening in will want to check us out. We're gonna have a good squad again this year.
Yeah, Evan Lettern is back, I know. That afro is big on the sidelines, though. I mean, that is an alarming. Yeah. That is kind of an alarming afro. You're like sitting there, like, damn, that, like, okay. Okay,
hey,
yeah.
All the recruits know we don't have haircut rules.
Is that part of the sale, right? Is that what Alex tells you? He's like, look, this is good for recruiting?
I mean, you know, I don't really think of it that way, but I mean, I do point it out. Hey, you know, it's one of the things I learned. I mean, in the NBA, you don't get to have control over those type of things. I think I do a good job, for the most part, of allowing my players their appropriate freedoms and then holding them, you know, really strongly accountable for the things that most affect winning. I think we're getting that combo right. And, you know, fortunately for us, the guys who've chosen to come here all want to be pushed like that and want to have the freedom that living here, being here allows.
All right. Great stuff, man. Thanks for joining me. Appreciate it.
Hey, man. I really appreciate it, Doug.
Hey, my thanks to Russell Turner, the head coach of UC Irvine. My thanks to you for downloading, subscribing, and rating this podcast. Remember to listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show every weekday afternoon, 3 to 6 Eastern Time, 12 to 3 Pacific, on Fox Sports Radio, the iHeartRadio app, or SiriusXM 217 or 203. And keep listening and tell friends about this podcast. If you have questions or comments, things you want me to get to, at Gottlieb Show is the Twitter handle. Make sure you tweet it out at me, and I will respond. Thanks for listening. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball.